Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. A man of distinguished courage or ability, admired for his brave deeds and noble qualities. That's how the dictionary describes a hero. But in real life, heroes don't necessarily stand out, and acts of heroism are not always admired. On the contrary, they can lead to ostracism, jail time, even death. So why do otherwise ordinary people risk their careers, reputations, and sometimes their lives when it would be easier or safer to do nothing? Journalist E.L. Press explores this question in his book Beautiful Souls, which was chosen as the inaugural text for the Penn State Reads Initiative. E.L. Press, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Your book, Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times, it tells the story of four, what you say, otherwise ordinary people, people who risk their careers, their reputations, and in some cases their lives, to break with the group and do what's right. What inspired you to examine this human capacity for moral courage?
Partly it was a real belief that, for understandable reasons, we've had a lot of books written in the last 50, 60 years about conformity, about evil, about people who sort of just go along and follow orders. And that's certainly understandable because, again and again in history, we've witnessed calamities and situations that have occurred from the Holocaust on through to a lot of modern wars and misfortunes that have taken place, where too many people did go along. And so the lesson drawn was human beings are by nature conformist, they're sheep. We all have this inner tendency to hold on to our principles right up to the point when the group or an authority figure is telling us, ordering us to do something, and most of us go along. And I don't in any way deny that in this book, but I felt that there's a lot less, and certainly a lot less compelling material out there on the exceptions, the people who don't go along. And I felt that there were some basic misunderstandings about what impels this kind of act.
You call them ordinary people in extraordinary times and say it's not helpful for us to look at these people as saints. Why not?
Well, first of all, because it's not accurate. I mean, in most of the cases, and if people dip into the book, they'll get a sense of this right away, there is this kind of puzzle to these people. That is, I went around interviewing relatives and also interviewing directly the characters themselves in the book.
In fact, you interviewed every person that you featured except one who died back in the 80s, I guess.
That's right. Well, and if I focus just on him for a second. So Paul Gruninger is in the first chapter of the book. He was a Swiss police captain. And in 1938, he received the order that all the police captains in Switzerland received, which was to enforce a new law restricting immigration, particularly Jewish immigration, into Switzerland. Now, the backdrop here is that the Nazis have just taken over neighboring Austria, and Jews are being expelled, and they have nowhere to go. It's not just Switzerland to blame there. It's the entire Western world that isn't accepting these refugees. But Gruninger is given this order. He goes back to his canton, this area of Switzerland bordering Austria, and he lets hundreds, possibly thousands of people into this canton and helps hide them, helps falsify their papers, even though he's the police captain responsible for enforcing the law. So you hear this and you think, well, this guy's got to be a kind of saintly figure of some kind. And that's not at all what I found. I actually met his daughter, Ruth, who is still alive. I said, you know, so what was it? Tell me about your father. And the word she kept using was he was normal. Normal. Now, obviously, he didn't act normal, but I think that in and of itself tells us something very interesting.
Well, interesting that he should not obey orders, because here is someone who spent his whole life following orders. He believed in his country. He was dedicated to his career. You say his mistake, in a way, was that he got too close. He allowed himself to see these Jewish refugees face to face.
That's right. I mean, it was a mistake in the eyes of the authorities in the Swiss capital, who eventually investigated what was going on, because they got these reports that refugees were still finding their way into St. Gallen, this canton. So what was going on? And as I researched Gruninger's story, I discovered that one of the things he did, which was very different from the other police captains, is he did not delegate this to someone below him in the chain of command. You know, you do the dirty work. I don't want to have to do this. He also let refugees come directly into his office.
So he heard their stories.
He heard their stories. People would come and plead with him. There are actually recorded cases of people saying, look, I made it out. My parents are stuck. They've been sent to prison, to what was a forerunner, a precursor of the concentration camp, the German prison camps. And is there any way to get them out? There are actually cases in which he would then summon people to come to his office. He wouldn't say why. In Switzerland, these people would then come across the border and he'd help them get refuge as well. But yes, he made this, what the authorities thought was a mistake, and as his daughter said to me, you know, in these face-to-face encounters, he just felt he couldn't do anything else. Now, I don't fully agree, except
because
that.
Lots of other people did the exact opposite of what he did.
That's right. He could very easily have been one of those officials who said, you know, gee, this is really hard. It's pulling on my heartstrings. I just won't see these people again. I will delegate it now to someone else because I want to keep my job. So this really is a book about choice and what people do in these situations that require them to make a choice between a loyalty to their job or an institution or their country and a principle.
And in every single case, and there are four major cases and then some other incidental characters in your book, they all paid an absolutely steep price. Reputations, jobs, homes, in some cases, they lose families.
Yeah. Well, the other reason I wrote this book is because I felt that a lot of the stuff that I saw that had been written about people like this was troubling in two ways. First of all, kind of honeycoating what actually happens when you step out of line for a principle. We know that in police states, in authoritarian countries, you're going to get in trouble, big trouble, for doing that. I think what we don't appreciate sufficiently is that in a democratic, open society, and most of the stories I tell take place, Switzerland, the United States,
Israel,
these are democracies, and these are countries where people do have a whole set of rights that they can call on when they break ranks. And yet, very often, they do end up ostracized, labeled traitors, labeled in all kinds of ways that are extremely painful and unsettling. And the book is actually written in a way that I hope forces readers to grapple with how we actually feel when people around us take a stand like this, as opposed to how we think we feel. I think the way we think we feel is great. It's wonderful. How noble. When it happens right in our own workplace or our own neighborhood or our own country, the response tends to be different.
In fact, you say that in most cases, the person who takes the stand is vilified and not redeemed, really, until they are proven to be right, and then they're morphed into a hero.
Well, very often, yes. I think that there's a problem with both of those things. There's a problem with vilifying the person and not hearing what they're saying soon enough, right? So the actual a warning may be heeded if people just took the label traitor or whistleblower or whatever it is away for a second and just thought, okay, what is this person saying? And might it be true? And if it is true, might it really be doing real damage to our country or to the community we're a part of? But the other thing that happens is that after the fact, and sometimes it's not immediately after, it's years or even decades after, there is this tendency to kind of put these people on a pedestal. And I don't think we see them clearly if we think of them as these saintly figures. I think we are being a little disingenuous. And in a sense, when we act as though these kinds of acts of principle require a saint, then we relieve ourselves.
Reach.
That's right. That's a standard none of us can really meet. So therefore, fine, let's go on with our lives.
Right. You say it sort of lets us off the hook.
It does, I think. And how many Nelson Mandelas or Mother Teresas are there out there? On the other hand, if we look at some of the people I wrote about, they never thought of themselves in those terms. And, you know, in some ways, their actions beg questions of all the people around them who could have acted in similar ways.
Let's talk about one of the people you write about who in some ways touches home for you, and I'm talking about Avner Wischnitzer. He was this very nationalistic, very patriotic young man who joined Israel's Defense Force, the most elite fighting force in Israel, the IDF. and served honorably for several years. And afterwards, his sister asked him to go watch a documentary film about the oppression faced by the Palestinians living in the occupied territory. Tell us a little bit about how there was an awakening, really, after doing that.
Avner is just an amazing person, I think, and an amazingly interesting person to write about, because when I met him, he was still trying to process this whole transformation that he had undergone. He was, as you say, really deeply patriotic. He served in the top unit of the Israeli army very proudly, grew up on a kibbutz where there's a tradition of this, the kibbutzim, these collective farms in Israel that send the best of the best, the top soldiers, to the top units. He was one of those. And then he goes to this lecture and he sees these slides. He sees Palestinian farmers whose land has been desecrated, whose trees have been uprooted, and he grew up on a farm. He didn't accept it, but he was disturbed. He was really bothered. He was fidgeting in his chair. He decided, I have to go see this for myself, because if this is really happening and my army has authority over this territory,
the most moral army in the world, in his eyes.
Yeah, that's indeed how he thought of it. And he goes through an awakening where he eventually decides, although he very much wants to serve his country, he will not serve in a mission in the occupied territories. And that break, which I chronicle, in some ways, the way he described it, I mean, I can just offer some sense of how difficult it was for this guy. As I say, he served in the top unit of the army. They did a lot of risky missions, and that's well known. He said to me, without divulging details, saying no to my commander on this was 10 times harder for me than anything I did in the army.
And he said the way he felt was to not stand up against the oppression, was to be an oppressor.
Yeah, he basically came to believe that if he was silent, that was a form of complicity. And he did this in spite of the fact that he had people very close to him, including his own father at the time, who said to him, look, if you have a problem with something the army's doing, vote. You know, protest, march, but don't do it through the army. And yet Avner felt, he came to feel, that in the position he was in, given the kind of respect accorded to top soldiers like himself, it would echo throughout the culture. It would just have a power that those other things would not. Now, of course, the power he felt, the impact immediately that he felt, was that for 18, 20, 25 years, he'd had his society at his back, and suddenly the wind was in his face, and everyone was calling him a traitor.
How difficult is it to break rank, to stand alone?
I think it's incredibly difficult. And in fact, you know, in part I connected to Avner because I was born in Israel myself. I grew up in the United States, but I
And your father and grandfather were members of the IDF.
That's right. They both served. My cousins, same age as me, when they turned 18, they went to the army. I went to college. But in the back of my mind, there was this thought, wow, what if I was there? Now, initially, I have to say, growing up, that was not a conflicted thought other than I should be there to serve. I ought to be a soldier like they are because it's for a good cause. When I was in college, the first Palestinian intifada erupted. This was a popular uprising in which young children were throwing stones at jeeps and armored vehicles saying, we want our freedom. And I would see these images. I was reading the papers very closely. That was the first time in my life I thought, if I was there, what would I do? Because there were stories coming out of soldiers who were refusing. This was the kind of the origins of this discussion in Israel about what kinds of orders you should not follow. So that story, Avner's story, touched a very deep place.
One of the arguments of doing what Avner did was that if everyone who felt the way he did left, all you would have at the checkpoints, at the front lines, are the zealots, and that his presence would provide a balance.
That's right. And that actually gets to the complicated meaning of the title of the book, Beautiful Souls. In Hebrew, the phrase is Yafei Nefesh. And when you hear Beautiful Souls in English, you think, oh, how nice, what a compliment. In Hebrew, it actually has a critical undercurrent to it. And one of the critiques is that a beautiful soul is someone who wants to have their own hands clean. And if you want clean hands because you are so moral and you are so sensitive, great. But what about the rest of us who have to live in a complicated world where war and conflict and all these things, and God knows there's been plenty of that in Israel's history, the burden of having to deal with all that ugliness falls on other people, and it may end up falling to people who are less conscientious and less moral than the people who have these qualms. So there is that complicated debate. Is this going to help or is this going to hurt?
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is E.L. Press, author of Beautiful Souls, which tells four stories about people who did what they considered the right thing under extremely trying circumstances. There's a Swiss border guard who smuggled Jews in against policy, a Serbian who misidentified Croats to save their lives, an Israeli soldier who refused to continue to guard what he felt were illegal settlements, and a broker who blew the whistle on a Ponzi scheme. The book was chosen as the inaugural text for the Penn State Reads Initiative.
I'm honored to be here and to have a freshman class that have all read my book and are talking about these questions. Of course, I'm perfectly aware that it was chosen in the aftermath of the Sandusky scandal. And my thoughts about that are, I guess, twofold. First of all, I think it's a message from the university and the people certainly in charge of this program. Wouldn't it have been great if we'd had a person or two like the characters in this book stand up earlier and forward information to someone who actually did something about it because of how deeply it hurt the entire community? I mean, one of the ironies of these stories is that the people who break ranks are often seen as disloyal, but what they often end up doing is hurting themselves but saving the institution from a lot of pain that might otherwise have happened, or saving their country from potential pain if their voices are heard. And I think in the case of Penn State, there's probably a certain regret. On the other hand, you have an incoming class, and rather than have them not discuss these issues at all, I think the aim of my being here and talking to students in classrooms and hearing really interesting conversations going on in philosophy classes and others is that they want students who identify very strongly with this university and are probably going to be loyal to it for the rest of their lives in some way, to think about when it is that that loyalty is not as important as saying something about something that's happening that is not okay. So I think that moral education is part of what the university wants to instill.
Your book looks at sociology, at psychology, at neuroscience to help explain why some people do this and why others never take that risk. But you write about Henry David Thoreau and his brand of civil disobedience. And you talk about this idea of the good citizen versus the good man, which to me is really fascinating.
I didn't come up with the distinction, but I do talk about it. I think it's really, really important. So there are those who have said about people like Thoreau that, you know, if you merely want clean hands, that makes you a good man. It doesn't necessarily make you a good citizen because we have all these problems. You know, Thoreau didn't pay his taxes because of slavery and the war with Mexico at the time, and he took this principled stand. But he said in his famous essay on civil disobedience, it is not my responsibility to bring an end to slavery. Now, some people would say, and these critics have said, yes, it is. If you really care about this, your responsibilities extend well beyond just an act of refusal, just an act of hand washing, in a sense. Now, I will say that not all the characters in the book stop at hand washing. In fact, Avner is a great example of someone who
takes action.
He takes action. First, he refuses. Then he says, you know, it is my responsibility to change society. So he comes together with Israelis and Palestinians who have put their guns down and decided the conflict will never end this way, and formed a group called Combatants for Peace. And they are very active to this day.
Now, some of the other people that you highlight or focus on in the book, one is Alexander Jeftek, who is a Serbian who, at great risk, at great personal risk, saved Croats. He gave them Serbian names so that during wartime they would be shuffled off to a safe place. You also talk about Layla Weidler, whose story is not as well known as the whistleblower in the Bernie Madoff case, but equally as important.
Yeah, and that's why I found Layla and realized, wow, there is this incredible story. Layla Weidler was a financial broker in Houston, Texas. And as I go into the background of her story, it turns out that very much an immigrant, originally from El Salvador, who made it on her own, got through a very difficult period in her adult life, raising two kids on her own, and gets her financial license and really makes her way up in this world, lands a job at Stanford Financial. And Stanford at the time, this is back in 2002, very sterling reputation. In fact, they had the best dining room, they had a beautiful building, they had
beautiful
glossy
brochures.
Reports, beautiful brochures. Everybody bought it. And they had this CD that they were selling, the certificate of deposit, that you could get 7 to 10% a year, and it never went down. What a great deal, right? Now, you'd think, I'm saying this all in a way that suggests it can't be true. It couldn't be true. But at the time, everybody thought it was.
And she was the only one who said, the market is tanking. How is it that we're offering 7 to 10%?
Yeah, and she did that in part because she had been very embarrassed that some of her clients earlier, a few years earlier, had bought Enron stock. And Enron, of course, was the it company of the 90s until it imploded under an accounting fraud. And all those clients lost money. Layla vowed to herself, that's not going to happen again. So she's told to sell these CDs, and she did nothing more than her job, actually. She said, you know, how do they make 7 to 10% every year? She wanted to see the portfolio, and she was told by her own company, that's proprietary information, we can't show it to you. Now, a lot of other people might have been told that and kept selling the CDs. Layla said, well, if I don't know what I'm selling them, I can't recommend it. And as a result, she was singled out by management and she was fired. After she was fired, she put together a packet of documents with a letter warning the SEC. She sent the packet to the Wall Street Journal, to the Washington Post, and other news media outlets. No one responded. This was in 2003. And then by 2009, the financial crisis has happened, and suddenly Stanford is seized by federal marshals, and it is a Ponzi scheme, a $7 billion Ponzi scheme.
Her, second only to the Madoff, which was $65 billion,
right.
Her experience was typical. People who do what Layla did are ignored or mistrusted or silenced.
That's, again, part of the reason I wrote the book, to get at this sort of tension or, if you will, contradiction, I think, in our culture. I think we have, in the abstract, an admiration for people like Layla or for people like Avner Wishnitzer, people who follow their individual conscience. I mean, after all, Thoreau is taught to high school students still. And we are a country that we've certainly made more commercial films about whistleblowers than any other country in the world.
And they all have Hollywood endings, and those certainly aren't what happened in the case of any of the people you talked about in your book.
That's right, and it tends not to be what happens. So in the film Erin Brockovich, which I mentioned very briefly, I think she gets a $1 million check for having exposed Pacific and gas companies.
Layla has to send money back to Stanford.
That's right.
The SEC rules against her and says, you owe this company the signing bonus they gave you back.
That's right. She has to pay her bonus back, and she feels ashamed. And actually, even after the scandal was exposed, she was called to testify at a field hearing, and I record this memory of hers. She had to come forward in front of the regulators, in front of the people in her industry, and say what she did. And she still felt in some way, wow, I've betrayed the industry, because she watched their eyes on her and she could see that's the way they were looking at her. But in the same field hearing, the audience was full of defrauded investors. She finishes her statement. They give her a standing ovation. And that was kind of the first moment where she actually heard back from the people who ought to have been told earlier what she knew.
Some say that her story is the quintessential American story of whistleblowing. Talk a little bit about whistleblowing being an American invention. We coined the term.
We did coin the term, and there are more whistleblowers here than, as far as I know, anywhere else. In Japan, whistleblowing, very recent phenomenon, and the numbers are far smaller. Even in a lot of European countries, far less whistleblowing than here. So there is this tradition. We have very good laws on the books to protect whistleblowers. All too often, those laws don't end up protecting whistleblowers. And then there's the deeper cultural issue, which is, how do we actually feel about people who say no to the boss, or who expose the company, or who criticize the government when the government is doing wrong? I cite polling data in my book. I was quite surprised by international polling data. Americans actually tend to be less sympathetic to whistleblowers on the whole than people in these other countries are.
Let's talk a little bit about the Stanley Milgram experiments and how you have come to a slightly different conclusion about what it says about human nature.
Mm-hmm. Well, Milgram's experiment, probably the most famous social psychology experiment ever, took volunteers, and what they were told was another volunteer in a room who would answer a question on a word test. And every time the answer was wrong, the person was told to press down on a switch on a shock generator. The first few switches were very low. By the end, it's triple X, you know, extra strong,
danger.
And you actually can see this other volunteer who's answering wrong screaming, registering pain. And the question was, how many people would go along? And of course, the other person was an actor. This wasn't really happening. But Milgram wanted to test obedience, how many people would continue. And it turned out that 2/3 of the volunteers went all the way to the end, to the point where this actor feigned being unconscious. And one lesson that is drawn from this, which I think is a mistaken one, is that there is this kind of innately sadistic streak that people have. And people were laughing in the laboratory, so they were enjoying it. This is just the way we are. We are obedient, and we like to be in the position of authority. If you listen to what actually transpired in the labs, or you read Milgram's own very interesting book about it, it's very clear most of the subjects tried to stop. They wanted to stop. They pleaded with the authority figure, this person in a lab coat, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this. But Milgram ingeniously devised certain things that would be said to them, this phrase that the instructor used. Continue on. The responsibility is mine. The responsibility is not yours. It is mine. If anything bad happens to that guy over there screaming, it's not you who's responsible. It's Yale University, it's the lab, it's the experiment that's responsible. And that got people to continue. And basically, he identified a way in which moral responsibility was being passed along in the way that we so often can do so. We have endless opportunities in our ordinary lives to say, okay, it sucks that this is happening. It's terrible, but I'm not the person responsible. The administrators are responsible. And the administrators say, well, the president said so, not us. So everyone ends up passing it along.
Is there a way to take all of this information and engineer us to be more moral because of what you've learned?
I think the best way to do that is through enriching our discussion and debate of these issues. I think the cultural context is so crucial in terms of acts of dissent, whistleblowing, and conscience. They are effective and they happen to the extent that society is aware of the dangers of conformity, of groupthink, of group hatred. We are not always sufficiently aware of that, especially when the stock market's soaring and so forth. So we need to be very wary.
I think part of the take-home message and what you hoped as a result of your book is that more people would have the moral courage to stand up and do what's right. But when you look at what happened to Layla Wiedler or to Paul Gruninger, it may have people say, the price is too high.
I do grapple with that question. You know, if you tell these stories honestly, are you then deterring people from acting in a similar way? And there is certainly the risk of that. I guess I would say that the challenge for that not to be true lies on the people who believe we as a society need people like Layla to call out injustice before it cascades into a crisis that ends up hurting an entire institution, thousands of investors, people throughout the country. Layla warned in that letter, this will shame the United States of America and it will shame the financial industry. It all turned out to be true. So if we believe that we need more of this, then I hope what the book does is give people pause before they just accept those labels, traitor, rat, tattletale, to the person who stands out and defies.
A.L. Press, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
Our guest was journalist E.L. Press, author of Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times. The book is the inaugural text for the Penn State Reads Initiative. To learn more about the book or to hear more from this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.